Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 138 with Anna Barsky on using 1031 exchanges to avoid paying, well, defer paying taxes. When I first got into the real estate business, my main motivation was making money, since I really didn't have any. Tax advantages were a far cry from my financial mindset, or should I say financial-less mindset at the time. Now, a decade or so later, I've owned property for years that has gone up in value, figured out how to make money, have to pay larger tax bills than I did in the beginning, and I figured out how to collect rents, raise rents over time, and I see the advantages just over the last year or so of upgrading my portfolio at opportune times to higher dollar deals with greater potential rent, greater potential mortgage paydown, and greater tax advantages by stepping my game up. I recently completed my first exchange with today's guest, Anna Barsky of 1031 IPX, 1031 Exchange Company. And she has accepted my invitation to join us here and go through some detailed questions, which have been rather hard to obtain the correct answers for me during my own exchange that I just mentioned from attorneys and from accountants. So appreciate that Anna's here, and we might as well jump right in. All right. Welcome to the show, Anna. How are you doing today?
I am doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
So I've talked with the listeners ahead of our time here together, got them excited, mentioned our episode a few different times throughout a couple of the previous episodes. So I'm sure the audience is as excited as I am to have you on the show. But just if anybody didn't catch those and doesn't know who you are, would you mind giving a little background, company name, what you do, and what we're going to talk about today?
Absolutely. So my name is Anna Barsky. I'm a 1031 specialist. I work for a 1031 qualified intermediary called IPX 1031, and all that we do day in and day out is facilitate 1031 tax deferred exchanges. We probably do about 30,000 exchanges a year nationally. We're the largest 1031 company out there, and we're owned by a company called Fidelity National Financial, which is the largest title insurance company in the country. And many of you on the call have probably heard of the title companies that are owned by Fidelity, like Chicago Title, Fidelity National Title, Tycor Commonwealth Lawyers, the list kind of goes on and on. We happen to be the 1031 company for all of those brands. And our main role is to help guide clients along with their tax advisors and attorneys through the 1031 process, as I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about later with our specific role in holding funds. But in addition to providing the guidance and helping structure transactions, we also safeguard funds in between the sale and the purchase of the new property and draft all the 1031 documents that the IRS requires.
Great introduction, Aaron. This is also very important for people listening. A few years ago, there was actually a giant fraud case in 1031s where this guy was running around and buying smaller 1031 exchange companies, which would be one of the benefits of dealing with a very large, well-known provider. This guy bought title company after title company, or I'm sorry, 1031 exchange company, and he was using the money from other people's 1031s that are safeguarded and being held, basically for his own account. I think the guy went to jail, and I was like very scared, and I was, you know, afraid to do my 1031 exchanges. We had like $100,000 plus coming back from that deal. That's how you and I met, Anna, just so everyone listening knows, this is how I did my first 1031 exchange. And I was lying awake at night wondering, like, hey, is this money going to be here when we close on the next deal? And I'm here to report now as we're on the show. The money did show up for closing. The deal went, completely through both sides of it successfully. Do you have like a basic description of what a 1031 exchange is? If somebody's like in real estate, they're doing some investing, but maybe they're not sure how it works, what's the general overview of that, Anna?
Absolutely, Dan. And I appreciate you bringing up the security aspect because, what most clients and investors don't realize is that the 1031 industry is completely unregulated. So even though the IRS says, hey, if you want to do a 1031, you can't touch your funds, the IRS doesn't tell the 1031 company what they can and cannot be doing with those funds, which is why, you know, the story that you mentioned is actually not the only story that came out about 1031 companies, you know, either stealing money or making bad investments with the 1031 funds during the exchange period. So whenever you're picking a 1031 company, asking about the security features they're providing is definitely the number one kind of piece to consider. So I will get off my soapbox about that. But as far as what a 1031 is, it's actually a very easy transaction. It's part of Section 1031 of the IRS code, and it allows investors, real estate investors, to defer paying taxes when they sell any type of investment real estate. And all that they have to do is buy any other type of investment real estate to complete their exchange. So really all that a 1031 is a sale plus a purchase equals a tax deferral. And there are several taxes that are deferred through the exchange, capital gains tax and depreciation recapture tax. State taxes are also deferred through a 1031 exchange. Investors who are selling a piece of investment real estate that don't participate in a 1031 are looking at paying 28 to 35% taxes on the profits from their sale. And there's a couple other rules that, you know, you have to follow to have a successful exchange and transaction. But really the ultimate benefit is the tax benefit, and a 1031 involves a sale and a purchase of investment real estate.
Well said. You obviously have done a few of these in your day. So I recently had a conversation. There's a lot of hoopla out there in the marketplace right now. Actually, it was on one of the last episodes of my show, and the accelerated depreciation, or basically you buy a $10, $12, $15 million asset, commercial real estate, apartment building, whatever it is, the economics of it work in the, you know, the 10, maybe 5 million plus, because you pay an engineer about $10,000 and you get a first year depreciation paper loss that's very significant. And a lot of investors who are high income earners, this is important. It's important to me. And the comment the gentleman made as he was describing that was, oh yeah, I hate the 1031 exchange. It's kind of like obsolete. And it was on the heels of another thing. I noticed that when I did my 1031 exchange, for everyone listening to kind of understand some of the framework, it did turn me into a bit of a motivated buyer. All of a sudden I was kind of in a rush to reinvest that money and find the right deal. But for me, a right deal, Anna, is something that is also profitable, not just fitting the economics of what I can buy. It's got to kind of be in the right neighborhood. I sort of want low rents. I want to be able to invest additional capital over time and increase the value. And then ultimately, my goal as a 1031 repeat customer of yours, my goal will be in a year, 2 years, 3 years to resell that property and make an even larger gain, which allows me to level up into the next property. Would you mind touching on the deadline and some of that motivation? I'm sure you've witnessed people in my shoes who've had to obviously, you know, run fast, identify a property, and maybe some of them failed and didn't meet the deadline. Maybe some of them did meet the deadline. I mean, can you just touch on that, what the deadline is when you sell a property, and maybe some of your experience in some of the clients, just like my own?
Sure, yeah. So once the sale closes, the 1031 clock starts. And the exchange, or, you know, the client has 45 days from the closing of the sale to identify a potential replacement property, and 180 days from the closing of the sale to purchase one or more of the identified properties. You can only buy what's been identified within that 45-day period. And you're absolutely right. The clock, you know, starts ticking, and then the 45 days goes very, very quickly. So the biggest piece of advice I can give is plan ahead, right? So once you know that you want to sell a piece of property, you have the property on the market, let's say you have, you know, a potential buyer, maybe a couple potential buyers that have thrown out LOIs, or maybe you have a signed contract on the property that you're selling, you know, start looking for that new replacement property right away. You don't have to wait till the sale closes and the clock starts ticking. One question that I often get is, okay, well, you know, I really want to plan ahead. I want to do this right. I want to get a great replacement property. Am I able to put down an earnest money deposit and sign a contract for my replacement property before I close on my sale? And the answer to that is absolutely yes. So you want to get that lined up so the 45-day identification period and 180-day exchange period isn't an issue. Because, Dan, you're absolutely right. You know, once you get into kind of the 1031 game and the clock starts ticking, you may end up in a situation that just to get the tax deferral, you purchase a property that you otherwise may not have purchased just to get that tax deferral and complete your exchange. And we've definitely seen clients that, you know, do that.
I've never surfed, but I've seen enough videos on YouTube and on TV that you see like the guy catching the huge wave, right? The thing that's like 15 feet above him and it's curling over his head. And he surfs his way out of there and you're like, man, how'd that guy like ride the wave like that? That's like amazing. It's a miracle. For me, I sell a lot of properties, Anna. We closed 110 deals so far this year. So going to closing is nothing new to me. And I know a lot of people who maybe aren't doing the same volume. Man, closing a property to sell a property alone is a bit of a miracle in itself sometimes. There's inspections, there's mortgage contingencies, and we're just doing residential mostly, but I mean, I'm sure as you get up into higher dollar amounts, deals are falling apart at an equal or even maybe a greater rate than the deals are falling apart in our residential real estate flipping business. So it felt to me like to have the buyer get through their inspections, the mortgage, et cetera. I had all of that rolling first. Simultaneously, like you said, I was looking for and identifying the right property, and I did get lucky, and it felt like I was surfing a wave, and I like caught that thing just perfect. And I think I could see like the danger in trying to do the 1031 exchange, you know, 100% of the time at a high volume, maybe over the course of time, or maybe even with bigger dollar deals, and it's kind of like putting it all on the line. There must be some risk that, you know, one of the deals falls apart. Maybe I sell the deal and then all of a sudden the one that I'm buying is not suitable, or the financing doesn't come through in time, or any variety of things that could kill that deal. And then I'm kind of stuck holding the bag and having to make the payment on that, you know, on those tax gains that I was trying to avoid with the 1031 exchange. So I feel like I can't count on the strategy necessarily as like 100% go to sure thing for me, maybe over the rest of my entire life. But do you have any insight as to like what is the stick rate where people have placed the money with the 1031 exchange intermediary yourself, and then they had their exchange period expire and maybe had to pay the taxes? I mean, are we talking 50-50? Are we talking 75% of the time the 1031 goes fully through successfully? I mean, what are the numbers looking like on that end of the business?
I would say about 15% of our exchanges fail. And then there is a small amount that end up being partial exchanges. So in order to get the full benefit of the exchange, you have to buy property that's equal or greater in value to the property that you sold. So if you sell property for $1 million, the new property should be $1 million or more. You can also buy two properties or three properties to get to that $1 million threshold. So sometimes we have clients that want to buy a couple different properties, so they identify, you know, four properties that they could potentially purchase, and then some of those properties fall through and they end up buying, you know, $700,000 worth of real estate when they sold $1 million worth of real estate. So they have this $300,000 shortfall that they're going to be paying taxes on, which is called a partial exchange. So in addition to the 15% that fail, we also have a small percentage that end up being partial exchanges, you know, for that reason.
And in that instance where they had a 70% of the million, if their gain was, let's say, $500,000 on that initial sale, so they bought the $500,000 property, they held it however long or did what they did, and they sold it for $1 million. So their gain was $500,000. Do you know roughly what their estimated, you know, tax they would have had to pay on what gain? Like, would it be 70% of that gain or the $300,000? Like, how would they calculate that from the IRS point of view?
It's called a dollar-for-dollar takedown, which means the entire $300,000 shortfall is taxable dollar-for-dollar. So there's not a percentage interest or like some kind of an alloc proration that's made. It is, like I said, a dollar-for-dollar takedown. So if you sell for $1 million and you buy for $800,000, you're paying taxes on $200,000 of profit. If you sell for $1 million and buy for $700,000, you're paying taxes on $300,000 of profit. So in your example, if your gain was $500,000, $300,000 of that you'd pay taxes on, and then you have $200,000 of that gain left over that you could potentially get tax deferral on through a 1031 exchange.
Let's just twist the example a bit and say that they bought the property for $800,000, sold it for $1 million, but then only found the two out of the three closed and it was $700,000. Would they be paying only on their actual gain, or would they be in a situation where their gain was on paper $300,000, even though they only made $200 in profit?
It would only be up to the amount of your gains. You'd pay taxes on $200,000, but there wouldn't be any tax deferral in that scenario at all, right? So you've
got you. So in a sense, it would be a fail then.
You got it.
Makes sense. Okay. So I have a couple technical questions that I've gotten some answers from that I do not know if they were 100% accurate. And so one of those is the selling person or entity that sells the property. So if I, Dan Breslin, sell the property out of my name, do I have to buy the next asset in Dan Breslin, or am I able to, let's say, add, I have an LLC for my properties in Philadelphia. Would I be able to buy the next asset in that LLC in Philadelphia, or maybe a single asset LLC where I was like creating a new one for the new asset, or would I have to buy in my name because I sold out of the gain in that first property in my own name?
The 1031 rule is that you have to maintain taxpayer continuity. So the taxpayer has to be the same throughout the exchange, not necessarily the title holder. So if you're selling in your individual name, you have some options on the purchase side. You could take title to the new property in a single member LLC, of which you are the sole member. You could take title to the property in a revocable trust or a living trust, of which you are the trustee. And the reason that that works is because those entities are disregarded entities for tax purposes. And you want to make sure that you treat those entities that way. So the underlying taxpayer is still Dan. And that's really all that the IRS cares about, is that the underlying taxpayer is the same.
Gotcha. So if I was selling out of my LLC, the Philly LLC, sold the property, would I then not be able to buy that in another LLC? Because it would, even if it was a single member LLC, would I be restricted to have to purchase in that LLC again, or would I still have those same options open if it were my own company?
Yes, Philly LLC is a disregarded entity for tax purposes, a single member LLC of which you are the sole member. You would have those same options that I just mentioned for the replacement side.
Am I correct in assuming that I'd be restricted to, I wouldn't be able to say, you know, take my gain from Philly member LLC and then invest in a partial LLC interest of, say, an apartment complex or something of that nature where I were going in on a syndication? Would that be excluded from this scenario?
Correct, because if you're buying into another entity, one, you can't purchase an entity interest. So you can't buy a partnership interest or an LLC interest to complete your exchange. You have to buy fee simple interest in real estate. So that's issue number one. And issue number two would go back to the taxpayer continuity, right? Because you sold as an individual taxpayer or in your individual single member LLC. Now you're buying in a partnership, which is a completely different taxpayer.
Got it. Makes sense. That is much better clarification than I received from both my counsel and accountant on the one that I had just done that we just passed on. Do you have any examples of a recent 1031 exchange deal that might highlight some of the things we had to talk about?
Sure. And we do, you know, we do all types of exchanges. We do $100,000 rental condos and $100 million hotel deals and retail centers and things like that, and everything in between. So there really isn't a deal that we haven't seen. But just, I guess, kind of relating back to what we just discussed with, you know, buying a syndication deal, there are certain types of syndication deals that are 1031 friendly. So those would be your Delaware statutory trust or DST deals, or your TIC deals, your tenancy in common deals. And if you are looking to buy property with a partner, those structures would work best. And those are really the only structures that would make sense under Section 1031. So what you mentioned is a very common scenario. Hey, I'm selling property in my individual name or in my single member LLC. The property that I'm buying is a lot higher in value, so I need to bring in a partner. And, you know, we're going to form a partnership and then buy this new property together. And for the reasons I had mentioned, the partnership wouldn't work for 1031 treatment. But what would work is a tenancy in common structure. So the only way to buy property with a partner through a 1031 exchange is to buy that property as tenants in common. And a tenancy in common structure allows you to own an interest in the actual real estate as opposed to owning an interest in the partnership. So Dan selling his investment real estate would buy his replacement property as tenants in common with his partner Anna, which means that Dan and Anna would both be on title to the real estate. So that makes sense for Dan's exchange because he's buying a fee simple interest in real estate as opposed to buying a partnership interest.
Interesting. And I guess some of that would have to do that I could sell out of that interest at a later point and pay the gain, I guess is the thinking.
Yeah, so the tenancy in common structure allows flexibility with the 1031 exchange. So when that replacement property does sell, you could do a 1031 exchange with your piece. And if I want to do a 1031 exchange, I could do that as well. We could buy our new property together if we want. We can do that again. Or we could buy property separately. So again, the tenancy in common structure allows for the most flexibility and is really the only way to buy property with a partner. You know, it's really the only 1031 friendly option for kind of a partnership transaction. But we understand that in a lot of cases, it's difficult to manage a property if you have a bunch of different title holders as opposed to just having one partnership that's on title. So sometimes that structure makes sense and sometimes it doesn't, just from a practical management perspective.
It sounds like it's probably a very minority number. I mean, we're probably talking that's very rare and coming across your desk, right?
It's actually pretty common.
Okay. I stand unassumptively.
Yeah. Pretty
incorrect.
Yeah, a lot of the times it's if someone has a tax deferral that they're trying to achieve, that's really the only way to do it. So they'll buy property as tenants in common with a partner or with multiple partners, and then a couple of years down the road they'll consolidate into a partnership entity and hold the property in a partnership. And of course that makes it difficult if they sell the property years later and they want to separate, you know, they want to do a 1031 exchange and separate. But ultimately, that is something that occurs fairly often, done through a tenancy in common structure initially, a couple years later rolled up into the partnership to make it easier from a management side.
Are those deals that are done that are happening in that method, are these like typically higher dollar, $1 million plus deals, or are these like smaller, you know, $100,000 or less? Do the dollar amounts have any impact on that tenants in common structure?
Yeah, and I would say it's more the type of property. We're a national company, but my territory is here in the Midwest. So I cover Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. And, you know, there's areas in Indiana where you could sell a huge strip shopping center for $450,000, right? And, you know, sometimes there's partners that are involved on that deal. So it's not really the dollar amount as much as it is the type of property. But I would say commercial is really where this structure occurs the most often.
Makes sense. Cool. So I'm going to change the direction just a little bit here. Is there a hold time requirement for the initial property, which is then sold at a gain, in order for that transaction to qualify for a 1031 exchange?
Technically, no. There are no holding period requirements in the 1031 code. So the IRS doesn't say that you have to hold the property for a year or 2 years in order for it to qualify for 1031 treatment. That's true in most cases. There are some special rules for vacation homes and second homes and related party transactions. There are holding period requirements in those scenarios, but just generally speaking, there are no holding period requirements with 1031. However, there is a rule that says property held primarily for resale is not exchangeable. So if you have held your property for a short period of time, either the one that you're selling or the one that you're buying, if you are audited, that can come into question, that held for requirement. So the held for rule really relates more to those that are flipping properties. So there's a lot of clients out there that, you know, go out and buy single family homes, you know, fix them up and flip them, or developers that are buying land or buying a building and tearing it down and putting a new one on there and then selling that building. The IRS doesn't allow 1031s for those types of investors because those assets are considered inventory as opposed to investment. So the IRS says that your intent when you're buying the property should not be to fix it up and sell it. It should be to get cash flow from the property, get some rental income, hold on to the property for a couple of years, and then sell it down the road. So even though there aren't really holding period requirements, you don't want to be in a situation where you're considered what we call a dealer and the assets are considered inventory. They have to be considered investment. And again, if you're audited, that time period may be something that is in question.
Gotcha. That makes sense. I mean, it sounds like the kind of thing, like if you did have some scenario happen one time, you know, maybe it wouldn't raise a flag. But for a flipper who is going to do that over and over and over and over again, it's kind of hard to say like, yeah, my intention every single one of these times was to hold it as a rental. And this guy knocked on the door and just made me a high offer. So I had to sell it.
Exactly. A pattern is something that would not work in your favor if you were for some reason to get audited. So if your main business or even your side business is flipping properties and you've shown that pattern, you've never had rental properties, you definitely don't qualify for a 1031 exchange. But if you have some rental properties here and there, and let's say you purchase a property, you rent it out, and then a month later someone sees it, falls in love with it, gives you an offer you can't refuse, I say go ahead and do a 1031 exchange because you don't have that pattern of flipping properties. You know, your intent was to hold on to it. You showed that intent by renting the property and you didn't solicit the sale. So I think that is a great exchange opportunity. So it's kind of a case by case basis.
Is the solicitation of a sale something that would be written into that same restriction? Like, hey, if you were to solicit the sale and they saw the active, you know, listing right afterwards, you kind of have like the smoking gun and you shouldn't have done that, right?
Yeah, I'm sure that's something that the IRS could potentially use against you, again, only if you're in a situation that you're audited.
Yeah, and I ask these questions. I mean, I follow the spirit of the law and the spirit of the tax code with the way I file my taxes. I try to consider like what they were after and try to do things, you know, as right as possible in there. So I'm not trying to get around them with this questioning, but just trying to understand the actual intent of what they were trying to get across when they wrote these different codes into place.
Right.
Disclosure aside, I have another example here that I'd like to run past you because I was confused about it when I looked at a couple deals that were going to be done with 1031 exchange. So I'm going to keep the numbers small just for simplicity's sake here. Person buys a property. I buy a property for $100,000. 5 years later, the property has gone up in value. I do a refinance and I take a $140,000 mortgage against that property. And let's just say later that year, I end up with a sale on the table at $180,000. And so I end up with cash received at closing of $35,000. We'll just say I paid $5,000 to an agent closing call. We're keeping it simple here. How would the 1031 exchange work in that instance?
Sure. So the value of the exchange is the same no matter how much debt you have on the property, no matter what your profit is. The 1031 rules are always the same. You have to buy property equal or greater in value, which is the contract sale price minus closing costs and commissions. So in your example, it would be the $175,000. And you have to use all of the proceeds from the sale towards the purchase of the new property. So I think you said you have about $35,000 of proceeds left over, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So you'd go to buy your $175,000 asset. You'd have to use the $35,000 in equity first. And then the $140,000 that you have kind of as a balance, you can either get another loan or you could throw in cash or you could do a combination of both.
Okay. That was one that some larger apartment investment folks are using as their strategy, and they're pulling that cash out of these deals and doing the 1031s at a later point. And I guess they were correct in the way they described it. So I appreciate you bringing me up to speed on that one.
And you definitely don't want to do a refi right before a sale in a 1031 exchange, but you can, of course, refinance your property and then a year or two down the road, sell it. And again, the rules would be the same as far as the value of the exchange.
Yeah, is there actually like a restriction or rule regarding the refinance and the timing of that that would help us be aware?
There's not really a time period, but it is frowned upon to refinance right before a sale that involves a 1031 exchange. So it should certainly be a couple of years beforehand. Otherwise, the transaction can be seen as aggressive.
If the transaction's seen as aggressive, is there a task force or an audit force that comes back? I mean, what's the risk of that type of scenario where someone does refinance and sell 2 months later?
Well, it would only come up again in a case of an audit. So it wouldn't, you know, 1031 doesn't necessarily trigger an audit, but if for some reason the taxpayer was being audited, there's a 1031 involved, that would be a piece of the transaction that the IRS would look at, most likely.
And potentially disallow that 1031 after the fact during the audit?
Potentially. And it's difficult for us to know exactly, you know, what the IRS auditor on that particular day would be thinking. But generally speaking, when we say it's an aggressive transaction, that means that that's something that would be questioned under audit and potentially disallowed.
It's the kind of thing you wouldn't want your client calling you up and doing that every third year with each one of their 1031 exchanges, right? I mean, at some point, would you guys even, like, besides frown upon it, not necessarily do the exchange on their behalf?
So we don't play judge or jury. And with our role, our kind of very limited role as the 1031 intermediary, we're actually prohibited by the IRS from giving any legal or accounting advice. So our job is to raise any red flags that we see, and then it's up to the client and their tax advisor on how they'd like to proceed. So to answer your question, if the client said, hey, I've discussed this with my advisors and we want to move forward, we would certainly still handle that transaction.
Perfect. So my last example slash question here is kind of pertaining to what the deal that we actually did, but there's a secondary question that would be attached to it as well. So we sold the property for $125,000 and we had to put $3,000 in escrow at that deal, which is about to be released. It's been like 6 or 7 months since we closed the deal. We bought the property, used the entire proceeds the way we were supposed to, but now I have the $3,000 returning from escrow. Do I have some obligation to report that to you or anyone else? I mean, how does that escrow get handled in that scenario?
So is the $3,000 a holdback at the closing of your sale?
Correct.
Yeah. So that's a pretty common scenario. So the holdback is only an issue if it's not released to the 1031 account before the closing of the replacement property. If it is released before you have to close on your replacement property, that's fine. It doesn't affect the exchange in any way. In your scenario, it sounds like it was released after. So I'm not sure if your 1031 company gave you this option, but option number one would be to replace that $3,000 with your own cash so you can get the full benefit of the exchange. Otherwise, that $3,000 would simply be taxable to you, and it's just the $3,000.
Gotcha. That makes sense. And then I guess the second piece of that was the overage funds on an exchange of some type, are they able to be used to like renovate or improve the property to carry on the rest of, you know, can I buy a property for more money, get some improvements done with overages and things like that? Or is that kind of like, I don't even know that how this scenario would unfold or what it would look like, but have you seen people do renovations or improvements to the replacement property?
We have, and that has to be done under what's called an improvement exchange or a built-to-suit exchange. And the transaction would have to be set up as such because an improvement exchange is a completely different animal. It's very different from a regular exchange. The improvement exchange has to be set up prior to the closing of the replacement property. The reason is because the IRS doesn't allow the exchanger to take title to the property until the improvements are done. So during the time that that property is being rehabbed, the exchanger doesn't have title to that property. Title to the property is actually held by us as the 1031 company. So the way that it works is we set up an LLC, which we are the sole and managing member of, and we use the funds in the 1031 account to buy the replacement property. During that time, the client have us make appropriate disbursements out of the 1031 account to improve the property. The improvements would have to be identified within the 45-day period, just like the replacement property would be. And then whatever improvements are done during the exchange period, during the 180-day exchange period, would count towards the value of the exchange. So let's say you have a client that sold property for $500,000. They bought another property for $300,000. Then they put $200,000 of improvements onto that property within the 180-day period to get themselves to the $500,000 value so they could get the full benefit of the exchange. So day 180, our LLC would essentially be selling the exchanger a $500,000 asset after those improvements had been done, and that way the client can complete a full exchange and get the full benefit of the 1031. In a super quick nutshell, that's how it works. Those transactions do tend to be complex. So, you know, the takeaway is they're certainly possible. You want to make sure you get the 1031 company involved before the closing of the purchase. So we set it up as an improvement exchange. You know, you want to make sure you're able to get a lot of improvements done within the 180-day period, because the time periods are exactly the same in a regular exchange as they are in a reverse or in an improvement exchange. And the fees are a little bit higher in an improvement exchange than they are in a regular exchange. So there's also kind of an assessment that is done beforehand, because you want to make sure that the tax you're deferring on the value of the improvements is worth the fee.
Perfect. That is interesting. That's a quick deadline there for the improvements, the 180 days. Are there many of these that come across your desk?
We probably do about 80 of them a month nationally. And we have a specialized department that handles them. So we have about 10, 12 full-time employees. That's all that they do day in and day out. So it is a smaller part of our business because of the fees, and it is a very kind of specialized transaction that only makes sense in certain scenarios. But we do about 80 of them a month.
So you mentioned 1031 of the IRS code. If somebody's listening right now, or even myself, if I want to get to become, you know, a little more of an expert at these so I can identify and structure my deals on the front end before I'm even bringing them to your desk, should I read that entire section of the code, or is there another book maybe that's directly suited, or perhaps like a website or anything I could go check out?
I recommend that you check out our website. It's www.ipx1031.com. We have a great website with a lot of information. It's very interactive. So there's calculators on there where you can calculate your capital gains tax and your tax liability. You can calculate your time periods. There's different memos on various topics like improvement exchanges or buying property as tenants in common, and, you know, various checklists of some of the basic guidelines. We also have monthly webinars that you could sign up for. One is kind of a basic webinar. The other is a more advanced webinar. So I recommend checking out our website. Again, it's www.ipx1031.com.
Cool. My last question is, are there any other books or places that would be relevant for real estate related tax advantages or strategies that you might know of and could recommend to our listeners?
You know, there's a couple things that I don't know if you have a website, but there's a couple things I can send to you to post. I think reading actual regulations is very tricky and very daunting. So having a resource that kind of summarizes the regulations and also summarizes some of the private letter rulings and revenue procedures is a little bit better and easier, just a little bit more friendly. So there's a couple items that I could send you that we produce. That would be a great resource.
So is that something that maybe you'd like to share your email address? So if someone wants to reach out, get in touch with you guys to maybe facilitate exchanges, is that an appropriate request that our audience could make from you guys?
Absolutely. We have tons of information, but the piece that I really like, it's called our reference guide, and it goes over all the 1031 issues and topics that could pop up and gives you a nice little summary in a very easy to read kind of format. So did you say like my email address?
Yeah, I guess if you don't mind sharing that with the listeners, I don't think they're going to like kill you where you're going to get like a million requests or anything like that.
No
but
problem.
There are people on the
no
show
problem.
who would be happy to reach out.
Absolutely. And if you want to reach out just to get this reference guide, that's absolutely fine. My email address is Anna, A-N-N-A, .Barsky, that's B as in boy, A-R-S-K-Y, @ I, P as in Paul, X as in X-ray, 1031.com.
And Anna is the person who handled my 1031 exchange, so this is one of my personal vendors. Hey, Anna, I know we're at the top of our time together here. I appreciate you closing the door, taking the time out of your busy schedule and sharing all this wisdom. I've got pages of notes, and I'm sure the listeners do too. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Dan. Have a great rest of the week.
And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Keep an eye out for the next episode. Aaron Fragnito and I talk about building $1 million per year wholesale business and then buying the right rental real estate deals. You don't want to miss it. Are you interested in a pre-release access of that episode? That is, before the email goes out on Saturday? When you subscribe on YouTube or one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, you'll receive advanced notification as soon as episodes are published, as opposed to Saturday when the email is sent. If you prefer the email, just head on over to reidiamonds.com and sign up. Attention deal makers, I am buying. I am buying houses and apartment complex deals in Atlanta, Chicago, Philadelphia, and Florida, as well as New Jersey and Delaware. So if you have a deal, please contact me directly using the form at reidiamonds.com. Are you an accredited investor who is interested in short-term passive mortgage investment opportunities with double-digit returns? Head over to fundrehabdeals.com to check out available high-yield investment opportunities. That concludes this episode. I thank you again, my loyal listener, for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here, signing off.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.